Friends, welcome back to the Ageless Athlete Podcast, where we bring you stories and secrets of age-defying adventure sports icons. This is your host, Kush Khandelwal. It's spring here and days are getting longer and it's a great time to be alive. Love the show, hate the show, DM me on my social media handles or just send me a note at kush@agelessathlete.co. While I mostly love talking to outsized adventure sports icons, sometimes it's an honor to have a great athlete who has turned their passion into a career to help others realize their athletic aspirations. Today on the podcast, we have teen climbing prodigy turned climbing and fitness savant, Dr. Natasha Barnes, who will help us cut through the confusion around exercise, fitness, and longevity in climbing and life. Natasha is a former winner of Bouldering US Nationals, who says that she didn't even think she could be climbing at that higher level, much less competing in powerlifting or doing the profession she does now. She talks about many things. In this masterclass, we will cover why strength training may be the closest thing to a silver bullet. We uncover some surprising truths about injuries, rehabs, and MRIs that will change how you view physical setbacks. We'll talk about some longevity secrets from an elite who is still crushing than ever 40. Natasha says she's better than she has ever felt as an athlete. And then finally, we will deliver some straight talk on nutrition, menstrual cycles, and the other make or break factors for consistent performance. Thanks again for tuning in. And if you want to move better, get stronger, and keep progressing, then just listen on. Hi, Natasha. Happy Women's Day.
So thank you, Kush. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Thanks for all that you do to help advance the cause of women's health, everybody else's health. Where are you now? Where are you from? And what did you have for breakfast?
I'm in Oakland, California. I've been in the Bay Area since 2005, but I grew up originally in Southern California, and that's where I started climbing. And I had protein oatmeal for breakfast. So oats and protein, and I put a little like cookie butter in there too, to make it taste good.
I love that. You get, yes, protein kick and, you know, a little bit of relief for the taste buds. Sounds awesome. It's been several years since we met, but I think I've known you for a fairly long time since I moved to the Bay. I mean, maybe close to 15 years. And even before I met you in person, your fame preceded you. And I remember you as being, you know, a teen climbing wonder kid. How did you go from being the steam climbing prodigy to, I think, competing powerlifter, and then now also a doctor of chiropractic and an authority on strength training for athletes, particularly climbers? Sounds quite the journey. Love to hear your thoughts on that journey. And then also, you know, when you were that young maverick climber, did you think that you would be where you are and what you're doing today?
No, definitely not. It's been a journey. Yeah, I think I started climbing when I was like 16 in like 1999. So I'm 40 now. And yeah, like an elite level powerlifter, even at 40. So it's been quite a journey. I found climbing because I was never really athletic as a kid. And it was like the first thing that sort of like clicked for me. So definitely back then, I didn't think I would even be climbing at a high level, let alone like competing in powerlifting or doing the profession that I do now. But basically, yeah, started climbing really young, got into competitions, figured out that I was pretty good at climbing, and competed at an elite level for a really long time, and also did a lot of outdoor climbing at a high level too. At a certain point, I started experiencing a lot of burnout from the sport and also just starting to get injured because it was the only thing that I did I was climbing. I didn't do any cross training. I didn't have an athletic background. So I started running into a lot of different injuries. And one of those injuries, actually a couple of those injuries, are sort of the reason why I pursued going to chiropractic school. My dad always used to go to a chiropractor, and he was sort of like a sports chiropractor. So not the traditional, not the super traditional chiropractor, but he would do also like rehab stuff. And he worked with athletes, and my dad was an athlete growing up. So I got to see how that chiropractor helped my dad. And I thought it would be a really cool job. And I thought that it would be really fun to help climbers as well. And I ended up like struggling with a couple of injuries as a young person, including like a finger injury, like a pretty severe finger injury, and a couple shoulder injuries. And doctors and like physical therapists and stuff really didn't have good answers back then. You know, they were just sort of like, I don't know, rock climbing seems really extreme. Like, you should probably just stop. And that wasn't really a good answer for me, because not only did I love climbing, but I was also making a living as a rock climber. So I couldn't just stop climbing, and my livelihood depended on it, you know? So it was just like a really depressing period in my life where I struggled a lot with injuries and wasn't receiving very much help, didn't really know what to do. And the information for like training and rehab just wasn't where it is now for climbers. So I went to school just to learn about these injuries and learn how to help climbers, and also learn how to help myself. And through that, I started strength training. My first job as a chiropractor was next door to a strength studio, and I would walk past there every day. And I was sort of a little bored of climbing and also just kind of injured. So at the time, like, wasn't able to push myself the way that I wanted to in my climbing. So I was like, you know, I think like strength really feels like it's a rate limiter for me in my progression for climbing. Like, I've always had very strong fingers naturally. I've had a lot of climbing experience and good coaches, so I had good climbing technique. But I really felt like I lacked like just pure strength. So working on that and learning how to develop actual strength seemed interesting to me. And so I ended up going to that studio and hiring one of the trainers there and getting into strength training. And it helped like it so much. It helped my climbing so much. It completely resolved like multiple shoulder injuries that I was experiencing. It got rid of a lot of aches and pains that I was experiencing. And ever since then, I decided to start incorporating that into what I do with climbers for rehab, and also what I do with climbers for like training. And also kind of got swept up in the sport as well, and also decided to start competing in powerlifting. And I've been doing that for the last 10 years. I took a little break from climbing. I think I took 6 years off of climbing to just focus on powerlifting, gained weight to be competitive in powerlifting and put on muscle. And yeah, I'm a competitive powerlifter. I have like multiple state records, and I have an elite level total, and I'm 40 years old, and I feel like better than I ever have. It's been quite a journey, but it's been a really, really good one. And I've been lucky enough to be able to impact the community in a positive way by spreading the message of strength training to a lot of the athletes that I work with.
Congratulations on this beautiful yet powerful journey. So many things you dropped there. You started off as a climber somewhere in your 20s, when a lot of people are, let's say, peaking and whatnot. You started getting these injuries, which hurt your performance. I sometimes think that we hear of athletes who continue to do well. You know, you see them in the media, and then people, when they drop off, you suddenly just stop hearing about them. You know, they just fade out. I was just reading and talking to somebody actually on this podcast about Katie Brown, for example. You know, she was setting records back in the day, and then suddenly, you know, again, disappeared. The question I'm coming to is, do you think there are lots of such stories of people in climbing, young, you know, young phenoms who were crushing, and then they dropped off because they got injured? Like, you dropped off because of that, but then you're kind of back in the scene. But do you think there are many people like you who could not cope with injuries?
Yeah, I think there's a lot, unfortunately. I mean, I know of people who I used to compete with back in the day who just don't climb now, or who just don't climb at that level anymore because they struggled with injuries and couldn't get back from them, or just quit the sport because it was too frustrating for them. But also, the younger you do a sport, we have a lot of research now around like sport, specializing in sport, and how bad it is for adolescents, because it leads to burnout. The way that you train for sports, especially a sport like climbing and certain other sports, is like highly specialized. And it doesn't develop other athletic qualities that we would want to see that help with longevity. And so a lot of people burn out because they're only doing their sport, they're specializing too early. And we see a lot of like dropout rates from that. And I think that also happens in climbing as well. I don't know if anybody listening would remember like Tori Allen, who was like a very young phenom back when I was competitive. She was really young. I think she was like, I don't know, like a teenager or a young teenager, maybe even like 12 or something like that, and just came out of nowhere and was like crushing all these comps and then almost disappeared as quickly as she showed up. And I think a lot of that was burnout and not necessarily even like injury, just like burnout from specializing early and like being very good and then just burning out fast.
Makes sense that there are these people who dropped out often because of injuries and maybe it's a combination of those things. The people who, when you look back, people you were competing with, people maybe who have not burned out and are still pushing, what do you think they were doing differently where they were somehow able to cope with injuries better, cope with fatigue better?
Yeah, I mean, I think some people are just lucky. I mean, a lot of like elite level athletes are just going to have superior genetics and they're just going to be able to handle more than the average person or somebody who doesn't have those genetics. I mean, I know a lot of elite level climbers. I won't name any names, but like some of the stuff that like they've told me that they're doing, I'm just like, wow, you are honestly like succeeding in spite of yourself, because what you're doing does not sound sustainable. It does not sound good, but somehow you're still winning competitions, doing that health behavior or like doing that crazy training program. And I think a lot of the time it's just elite genetics that allow and luck that allows people to do that. And then for some people, I think they maybe did have an athletic background before climbing, or they diversify in other sports, or they switch to other sports periodically and come back to climbing. And it's just more sustainable that way for a lot of people. That would be my thought.
It's fine to not take names, but maybe can you talk to a couple of things those people are doing, which make your eyes pop?
Yeah, I mean, one that comes to mind right away is I talked to a professional climber who was at a competition that I was at, and they were like, yeah, I've been here and I've just been eating like way too many croissants while I've been here. So after this competition, I'm going to do the protein diet. You've probably heard about it before. And I was like, the protein diet? What is that? Basically, their plan was to do this like detox diet that was called the protein diet, where you only eat protein for 10 days and you don't eat anything else. No carbs, no sugar, no fiber, no nothing, just protein for 10 days. And according to them, it was like going to detox their system, get the sugar out of their system and reset them so that they could feel better and, you know, compete in the next month or so. And I was like, that sounds like a really bad idea. Your training is probably not going to feel good if you're not eating like any carbohydrates to support that training. Like, of course, protein is great, but like you need carbs to fuel your training sessions. And they were like, oh, well, I'm just not going to climb for those 10 days. I'm just going to do the diet, not climb, not train. And then I'll start training again after. I'm like, okay, so you're going to take 10 days off, do this crazy diet, and then go to nationals and compete. And they ended up doing that. They ended up winning nationals. So it's just, all right. So some people succeed in spite of themselves and for no other reason sometimes other than they're just great athletes and they're very lucky. That's just one example that I can think of where if a normal person did that, they would probably not feel great. They would probably lose some strength and probably not compete well after just completely taking 10 days off of their sport and doing like an extreme diet.
Folks, the croissant to protein diet helps you win nationals. You heard it here first.
I don't know. I feel like sometimes professional athletes are probably not the best people to get like training or even health advice from because, you know, sometimes they're just lucky. And I'm probably somewhat lucky too, genetics-wise, with the success that I've had in sports. But also I feel like I also just persist and I stick with the sport for long enough to get good at it. I'm not just like naturally good at sports, even though it might look like that from the outside. So I don't know.
It's fascinating. And it's crazy to think that this quote unquote pure niche lifestyle sport that we call ours also has similar issues that other kind of professional sports do, where people will do crazy hacks to get good for competition. And once that ends, their bodies and their psyches can just collapse. It's the state of the world we live in. On a more cheery note, going back to your climbing days, any particular like peak moments that you smile when you think back on?
Peak moments. There's so many.
Of course, maybe a couple highlights.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot of like performance highlights that felt really good. I mean, I can remember winning bouldering nationals and that felt pretty good. I can remember like particular sends, like I spend a lot of time climbing in Yosemite Valley, and I'm sure you probably know this, but maybe some of the listeners don't. Yosemite Valley is like notorious for being like pretty sandbagged and being like a hard place to climb, especially a hard place to climb like iconic double-digit boulders. Definitely some of the sends that I've accomplished in Yosemite Valley are probably like in my top three of accomplishments as like an athlete, because just like demand so much from you of like technical excellence and persistence, just time spent learning the rock there and learning how to climb well there. And so those were really gratifying sends. They're hard. I mean, people who are like professional climbers come to the valley and can't climb like double digits, you know? So it feels good when you can get good at that style of climbing and like climb well at it. So those are probably some peak moments. And then, you know, obviously looking back at some of the great moments that I got to spend in the outdoors with friends and just like beautiful things that I got to see and like beautiful moments that I got to have like on the climbing wall that were just like something that you wouldn't get to experience unless you're a rock climber and you're out in the wilderness. Golden hour at Jailhouse, you know, is just like something else. Like the way that the light looks there and being up on the rock and being just like outdoors, it's just so beautiful. So I think some of those experiences are for sure like top tier.
Absolutely. Yes, one can quantify some of those peak moments, and maybe non-climbers can relate to maybe just that accomplishment piece, but those moments spent outdoors where so many things come together between the vistas and being in the moment, being with people you care about. I think those, you just have to be there. You can't really explain in words. The few times you've intersected while climbing, one of my moments I just remembered this morning when I was thinking about this chat with you was, I was in the valley as well. My time in the valley was mostly doing routes, but I sure mm-hmm. enough climbing, did a bunch of bouldering, mostly stuff that I failed at. But I remember one morning you were taking us through your warm-up circuit at the Camp for Boulders. And part of your warm-up circuit was doing blue suede shoes, you know, that slab problem. And I just remember trying it behind you. And I'm like, she climbed it so fast, I didn't even get a chance to see your beta. Yeah, you scampered up that thing, I think.
Yeah, those were the days having like climbs like that wired and have it be part of like your warm-up circuit. Although blue suede shoes was sort of like, it depended on the season. There were seasons where like I could just do that and it was part of my warm-up circuit. And for some reason, there were seasons where I'd go there and just like completely forget my beta and couldn't do it, or it would take me like multiple tries to be able to do. And like for some reason, I just never wrote down my beta, or like we didn't really have iPhones back then as much. And so like I didn't have an iPhone till a really long time. So I didn't have like videos of myself climbing that stuff to look back at and see my beta. So like some seasons I just would go there and forget how to do it.
It's so funny these days of everybody being ready with their phones and recording themselves. And if you tell the young, I don't want to say younger ones, but yes, people who are newer to climbing, and tell them that, oh yeah, we did not look at video beta. We either, if we were smart enough, we would write down shit, or we would ask other people. That's just how we learned. Such
totally.
A, things change so quickly. Getting back to some of the other stuff we want to talk about, would you go back and train differently, Natasha, knowing what you know today, like when it comes back to, I know you talked about strength training a little bit, what would you do differently? Do you have any like facepalm kind of moments where you were like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I was devoting so much energy to that thing, which did not give me
Oh my God, so many facepalm moments. I would for sure train differently. Like probably the biggest thing I would change is I would add strength training in. Mm. Like I didn't do any strength training for a really, really long time. Until I didn't start strength training until I was 30. So basically before the age of 30, I didn't do any. I mean, maybe we would do some pull-ups or something, but that was sort of like the extent of it. And I would for sure bring that in more regularly. I think it would improve both my climbing performance and also just help with longevity, help prevent injuries, and also just structuring my training differently. Like back then, before I started training for powerlifting and like having a better understanding of the scientific approach to programming for training, I remember we would sign up for a climbing competition and 2 weeks beforehand, we'd be like, all right, we're going to train. And we would train. We would do like some training. And it's, what are you going to accomplish in 2 weeks? Nothing. Like you can't. You have to be thinking about your training months in advance, or even be thinking about your training in terms of like your whole year and like your seasons. And with strength training, we do that. Like when I sign up for a meet, like I need to know at least 3 months in advance so I can right away start like prepping and training for that. So having a longer view of like my climbing training, I would probably also have. And I would also, I think when you're a climber and you're, especially when you're younger or you're newer to it and you're very stoked on it, I think it can be hard to be told like, hey, you should probably have an off season, especially in California. Like when I do rehab consultations with climbers, it's something that I bring up a lot because especially in California, like we can climb all year round. We can always find somewhere to climb and you can always be psyched on something. And so nobody ever has an off season where they're spending time like going back to basics, like doing a little more strength training, working on their conditioning, doing other things with their climbing. And I think if I could go back, I would make sure that I had off seasons and I would make sure that I planned out my climbing trips in my year a little bit more thoughtfully. And having that downtime is like hard, but like it keeps training more sustainable. It keeps your psyche up, I think, long term. And honestly, I think you're going to have better longevity in the sport if you approach it that way. And probably another big one is also nutrition. I didn't really learn much about nutrition until I started powerlifting because I started learning about it when I started learning about training. And that was a huge game changer for me. I remember being in my 20s thinking, you know, when you would go climb and you would have this like unicorn day where you're like, wow, why do I feel so good today? Like, What did I do that I'm like feeling so good today? And how can I like replicate this? And before I just had no idea. And now looking back, I'm like, oh, it's because you actually slept 8 hours. You like actually ate enough of the right things to fuel your session today, or you've been eating enough of the right things so you're more recovered. And so learning about nutrition and like making sure that I was like eating, you know, carbs to fuel training and climbing sessions, making sure that I was eating enough protein to recover from training sessions and long days is definitely something that I would do, because now my training is, I mean, it's normal to have fluctuations in your training, but my training is much more consistent now because I'm aware of the variables that kind of affect your training and how you perform, when the big ones are nutrition, sleep, and like stress management, or like your training program, like managing your load. And if you have those bases covered, you're going to have a lot more consistency throughout your training and your energy levels. So those are probably some big ones.
I captured strength training, I captured diet, I captured having a structure. But then this point about California having a 12-month climbing season, I immediately resonate with, because I think in our sport, we did not have a concept, or at least where we live, we did not have a concept of an off season. And just last year, this one climbing partner of mine, Luke, we were climbing a Donner, and Luke was like, and he's, you know, young and very sort of structured climber. And he was like, man, I'm just getting stressed that I'm not going to be able to rest the rest of this year. And I'm like, that is so funny. Telling somebody that they need a break from climbing so they can rest. But it just shows that I think knowledge also has come a long ways and people are aware.
Mm-hmm.
Just knowledge from a macro view, and let's say compared to other more popular sports, climbing, let's say we used to be in the dark ages with training and information. Do you think it's kind of catching up now with more popular sports?
think a little bit. I still think that climbing is a little behind on some of the research and some of the things that people do in other sports, but I do think it is starting to catch up. I think, I mean, when I first started strength training like 10 years ago and I started telling people about it, hey, you should try this, it's really helpful, it was like blasphemy, you know? Like people were like, what, strength training for climbers? I've been called like a quack on the internet. I've taken a lot of flack for saying that climbers should strength train, including training their legs, which back then people were like, why would you train your legs? Like, you don't need your legs for climbing, but like you do. If you know how to climb well, you're using your legs like at a high intensity in your climbing sessions. And also you're hiking to places with gear. You're also falling off of the climbing wall and you have to stick those landings. Like we need landing gear, right? But back then people were like, that's crazy. And also like, hell no. And now when you talk about strength training to climbers, you're like, oh yeah, like I should do that, or they already are doing it, which has been like a big change. And I think we start to realize that like every sport does it. Like every sport has an off season where they're focusing on strength training and doing it to support, like to build a foundation to support the rest of their sport practice. And so I think that's really cool. And I think like some of the training practices are starting to catch up, and some of the like rehab concepts and things like that are finally starting to catch up too.
Funny, when you go back and look at old climbing media and you see all those comp climbers, you know, with their wide backs and their, you know, stick thin pigeon legs. Yeah, it just makes you wonder if some of that knowledge had been gained, they would have been doing maybe 515s would have been climbed like 20 years ago. Who knows? You know, if people understood the value of whole body training and of all of those principles of exercise science that you allude to.
Yeah, I think maybe, but I definitely think that like people's injury rates would be lower. And I also think that like we would see less climbers having like knee injuries and I mean, injuries in general, but like definitely leg injuries like are on the rise for climbers. And I think people are starting to realize, hey, we need to train our legs, because like people are spraining their MCLs and LCLs and people are getting ACL tears and, you know, people are getting heel hook injuries and stuff like that. And so people are starting to realize, hey, there may be some value in training our legs.
I came into climbing from a weightlifting background, believe it or not. I was 25 pounds heavier. I was lifting a lot of weights. And I think I did find early progress in climbing because of that. I mean, I could do a bunch of pull-ups, yeah. You know, I could pull myself up without maybe learning technique as quickly. Mm-hmm. But I think the part that did hamper me is that my lifting was not designed to help me succeed as a climbing athlete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those things that you're talking about, being able to land successfully, being able to push with your feet better, I don't think I had those skills. So I never learned them, or I had to find other ways. Mm-hmm. How does strength training for climbers differ from just conventional strength training that you see people doing?
Yeah, it's really not that different, to be honest. I think some people will get caught up in this idea of making strength training look like their sport, and it really doesn't need to. And actually, like, we know from other sports that that doesn't work. We don't need it to be super specific. So strength training for climbers is GPP, which in strength and conditioning is just an abbreviation for general physical preparedness. It's general strength programs. We might emphasize a little bit more upper body for a climber than we would for maybe say a track athlete or something like that. But we're still going to do like full body training. It's still going to be pretty general, because if you think about what we're trying to accomplish when it comes to strength training, we're trying to increase muscle mass and we're trying to increase force production. And so we want to pick exercises and do programming that's going to be conducive for that. So for a lot of people, a good bang for your buck is going to be compound exercises. So exercises that use multiple joints and use lots of muscle. That way you're not trying to do 15 different exercises in each training session to hit like different muscles. You can do 3 or 4 exercises that are going to have your bases covered. I think one of the things that I find climbers doing is trying to follow like bodybuilding programs or powerlifting programs and trying to use those as a way to cross train, or to using those as their strength training. And we don't need to do bodybuilding style programming, because that's usually split up in like body parts. So it's like arm day, back day, leg day. We don't need to do that. And a lot of them are like more isolated exercises. Like bodybuilders will do like compound movements, but a lot of bodybuilding movements are, okay, we're going to do shoulders, we're going to do dumbbell this and machine that, and like a lot of like isolation exercises, where instead we could do some combat exercises that are going to be really good bang for our buck. We don't have to spend a lot of time in the weight room, which for climbers, like we don't need to be spending a ton of time in the weight room. Maybe you're spending a little more time in the weight room if it's your off season, but like we want to keep the goal with climbers, and the goal in climbing is to get better climbing. And so we want to just do the bare minimum, or like a minimum viable strength program that's going to help us build strength or maintain our strength, depending on where we are in our season. And so picking exercises that are really good bang for our buck, that allow us to lift really heavy and get a really effective stimulus, are going to be the best bet. I think that we don't have to. So basically, like, we want to keep strength training separate. And then if you want to translate that strength into your sport, we need to be practicing our sport. And we need to be figuring out things that we can do in our practice of sport to like shore up whatever we think those weaknesses are. So, you know, if it's using your legs effectively, yeah, we want to train our legs in the weight room. We want to train our knees so that they can tolerate the stresses we might encounter in climbing. But then we also want to be incorporating drills that help us connect through our feet and teach us how to drop knee, or teach us how to use our hips and our legs effectively when we're climbing. And so a lot of that just comes from like sports practice and consciously practicing those skills so that they can translate into like our harder climbing as well.
Great. Without getting too specific, for somebody who wants to incorporate more strength training into their program and use maybe more compound exercises, and I'm guessing those probably involve a combination of pushing, pulling, hinge movements types of things. Mm-hmm. For a typical week where a person is trying to do keep up their climbing training volume, maybe even do some climbing specific things such as hangboarding, etc., and strength training, what kind of general split would you recommend? And then I'll layer in a second question, which is, when you coach clients, again, everybody's different, I recognize that, do you prescribe programs which can be somewhat different for male athletes versus female athletes?
That's a good question. Yeah. So if we're looking at strength training specifically for climbers, even just like other athletes whose main focus is maybe another sport, the first thing we want to do is just to try to meet the physical activity guidelines. So I think there's a statistic that like a huge proportion of people, this is probably not as high for people who are already athletic, but 80% of people don't meet activity guidelines for health. And health, this is just for health. This isn't even for sports performance. So the health guidelines for physical activity are 75 to 150 minutes of high intensity cardiovascular activity, or 150 to 300 minutes of moderate cardiovascular activity, or a combination of both. And then 2 times a week of full body strength training that incorporates all major muscle groups in the body. 80% of people are not meeting those activity guidelines. If your sport is like cardiovascular based, you know, you probably are, or if you're doing like a strength sport, you probably are going to be more likely to be meeting those. But climbers probably aren't. And according to those recommendations, climbing and bodyweight activities are not enough stimulus to meet those requirements. They can be for some of the other physical activity, like the moderate to intense physical activity part of the guidelines, but for the strength guidelines, climbing isn't enough. So a lot of people are like, well, I'm already climbing, so do I really need to do that? Yes, because it's not enough to meet those guidelines. So I will be looking at meeting those guidelines, which is 2 times a week of strength training. It doesn't have to be 2 times a week. You can split it up into 3 or 4. If I work with clients who are like have a lot of time constraints, say they go to the gym after work and they have to get home to help their partner co-parent or something like that. They don't have a lot of time at the gym. They're like, I get an hour and a half here. Then maybe we're doing like more frequent sessions, and we're just splitting that 2 times a week into more sessions so that they can get that requirement in. But general recommendations is 2 times a week, full body strength training. So generally, if people are picking like some kind of squat movement, some kind of push movement, some kind of pull movement, and some kind of hip hinge movement. And you just pick an exercise from each of those categories. That's like a compound movement that you can go pretty heavy, where you can get about 4 sets per week on each of those at around a 6 to 15 rep max load is what we're looking at. That's going to be enough to meet the health guidelines. Now, depending on where someone is in their athletic development, what rate limiters might be in their climbing. Like for me, strength was a big rate limiter. I needed to do a lot of work to bring up my strength levels because I just wasn't very strong. So somebody like me might need to do more or might need to spend more time doing strength training in their off season to build up a little bit more strength that might be required in their sport or given their injury history or previous training history. But I would be looking at like meeting those minimums. And if you're meeting those minimums at least, you're probably going to be pretty golden.
That is such clear, clear advice. And one thing I love immediately about your general recommendation with an exercise or a strength training program is I was one of those doofuses who would do the armchair back leg kind of split. And that stuff always felt kind of complicated, yeah. You know, because, yeah, there were just too many exercises to keep track of. And I think the kind of program that I think you and I think others seem to also be advocating is that whole compound movement base where you're just doing a couple of things, but you're trying to do them with high intensity. And I think that takes away, I mean, training for climbing as is such a, you know, feel such a jigsaw puzzle. You're trying to do so many different things. So any opportunity to simplify is, yeah. And you know, the simpler a program is, the higher the chances that people will be consistent.
Yeah, definitely. I think compliance is a big factor. And for a lot of my clients, especially when people consult me for training plans, I feel like when we're talking to a coach or when we're like starting a relationship with the coach to start training, everybody is very excited. They're thinking like most ideal training program possible. And for me as a coach, I've worked with enough people that like I know if we jump into like most ideal training program possible, like life is going to happen. And when people start failing to do their training program, they lose psych, they lose momentum. And so for me as a coach, it's really important to keep things simple, to build like a minimum viable program for my athlete so that they can check the boxes off, because that builds momentum. If you're feeling like you're successful, then it builds momentum, it builds psych, it keeps you going. And then we can add like more things. We can make it more complicated if we need to. But having that minimum viable program is helpful because it does keep people actually doing it, you know, which is important. But yeah, and then to answer your other question that you had about the differences between men and women when it comes to strength training, there really isn't any. And according to the research, like men and women respond pretty similarly for the most part to strength training. And a little fun fact is that men and women are just as strong as each other when we correct for lean body mass. So what that means is if you take a man and a woman who have the same amount of muscle mass, a woman might have more body fat because women just tend to carry more body fat than men. But if we compare two athletes who have the same amount of muscle mass, they're just as strong as each other. So there isn't even really like a sex difference between men and women. It just has to do with like women in general who are of a certain weight tend to have more body fat than muscle mass. And so it looks like women are not as strong as men. But when we correct for that lean body mass, they're just as strong as each other, which is like a fun and encouraging thing. And women tend to respond just as well, if not a little bit better, to upper body training than men. And a little better probably has to do with the fact that a lot of women don't have as much strength training experience as men. And so their training age is a little younger. So they're just going to respond a little bit better. So that's a really fun fact. Another fun fact is that when you're 85 years old, you can still build muscle mass just as well as when you're in your 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And you 20-year-olds compared to all the way up to 65 to 75-year-olds in a 6-month training program build muscle mass just the same as each other. So age isn't even like a factor when it comes to building muscle mass, even though it can feel like that. When we look at the research, like we're building muscle just as well as we are in our 20s, in our 60s, in our early 70s. And when we put people on a program, according to one study, people put 11% on their one rep max, whether they were 20 or whether they were 75.
Natasha, multiple jaw drop moments right there. And for one thing, I'm just so impressed you have so much information at your fingertips. So, and I think particularly...
I talk about this all day, so...
Yeah, I mean, and those things about what you said about the capacity for both, you know, both genders to be able to just get just as strong when one makes certain accommodations, I think that thing needs to be like on billboards out there. And
yeah,
maybe particularly underlined for today being Women's Health Day. What you said makes total sense, that initially women respond a bit better because of just, I think maybe just, you know, old traditions and behaviors that need to really be discarded about what men and women should be doing for fitness and for health. One thing I notice, and this is again anecdotal, which is you go to the weight room and men are throwing weights around and yelling and grunting and doing whatnot, and women are out there, you know, doing 35 reps of the same thing.
Yeah.
So that's one immediate thing that men and women seem to do differently. Any other things that men and women listening, there are like some obvious fault lines that they need to just correct?
I think that, yeah, you know, as a society, like men are encouraged at an earlier age to exercise. They're encouraged to lift weights, whereas women are encouraged to like dance or, you know, do something else or not exercise at all. And so a lot of women, not every woman, obviously, but a lot of women just don't have the same strength training history as like men do. And so, you know, that's why it can sort of seem, you know, maybe women don't have as much strength as men, but it's more of a societal thing than anything else. I also think that a lot of women have trouble when it comes to like their menstrual cycle or when it comes to menopause. A lot of women will have objections around that. Some women don't feel very well during the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle, which is the week before they're going to get their period. And that doesn't mean that we can't train, and it doesn't mean that we can't make strength gains throughout the entirety of our cycle. But I think having a framework that you can use to help meet yourself where you're at is really important. So one of the things that I teach all of my clients is how to auto-regulate their training. And I think it's really important skill to have as an athlete. And auto-regulation is just like a framework we can apply to training so that you can get the correct stimulus for how you're performing that day. So the way that a lot of strength training works is like traditionally you would maybe, you know, let's say we're going to do like a deadlift or a squat. You would max out on day one. And then based on whatever you would do on your max out, you would be prescribed like a percentage of that for the rest of your training. Okay, we're going to do 85% for this or 75% for this. And the problem with that is that, you know, some days like 80% might be more like 100% for you. Mm-hmm. We know that like our strength levels can fluctuate day to day. And that has a lot to do with your diet, has a lot to do with sleep, has a lot to do with previous training, has a lot to do with your mood. There are so many factors that can affect performance day to day. So some days, you know, 80% might be more like 100%. And some days 80%, you know, might be even less than that. So it might not be an adequate stimulus for you if you're performing really well that day, or if you've adapted to your training and now you're stronger than that one rep max. So instead of using like a percentage-based training, I teach athletes to use a scale called RPE, which just stands for rating of perceived exertion. And basically you're rating your effort level on an exercise. And your body doesn't really know like the weight that you're lifting when you're lifting weights. You know, it doesn't know how much weight is on the bar. It only knows the stimulus that it's getting. So the weight literally doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're bench pressing 200 pounds or 100 pounds. If it feels like an 8 out of 10 effort, it's an 8 out of 10 effort. And so when someone is struggling during certain parts of their menstrual cycle, we can take advantage of the RPE scale. And we can meet them where they're at. So you should know as you warm up how you're, and it's based on how you're performing and not how you're feeling. because you could, I always tell my athletes, if you could feel like crap and perform really well. And we've probably all had that experience where we went to the gym, we're not feeling great, and then we send, or we feel really good and we're like, what? Where did that come from? And then days where we feel awesome and we're really motivated and we're psyched and we go in and we just don't perform very well. And so it doesn't have to do with how you feel. It has more to do with how you're performing. And you can sort of calibrate that based on like how your warmups are feeling. And then you can select a load that meets you where you're at for that day and make sure that you're getting an appropriate stimulus. So if you're not performing very well in a certain part of your menstrual cycle, that's okay. We just adjust the load so that you're getting the stimulus that we're looking for, but it's meeting you where you're at. So you're not having to lift like a certain amount of weight and really push yourself over that edge and like fatigue yourself. And when you're not performing very well, and then on days where we're feeling great, we can take advantage of that and put more weight on the bar and lift more because we're performing really well that day. So autoregulation and the RPE scale just helps you have better bad days and better good days. And so that is one thing that like a lot of my athletes will be like, well, I seem to perform differently based on where I am in my cycle. And that's okay. If we use autoregulation, like we're going to get the correct stimulus. And if we zoom out over time, we're going to be making progress.
So insightful, Natasha. And yes, the RPE just makes so much sense because we're all different. Every day is different. And exertion should really be how one measures one's performance. I had this really fascinating conversation with an ultra runner. This person, she is in her early 60s. And she has been podiuming and crushing ultra runs for the last 4 decades. So she's one of those super elite performers. And we had this really interesting conversation on changes in training for both menopausal and perimenopausal women. And one thing she talked about is how in her own journey, you know, she would be, let's say, at the 70th mile mark on a run, and then she would suddenly just lose all power. Like in the past, she would be able to power through that point, and then that just kept happening. So I was wondering if you also have clients or maybe other people where people have that just loss of power when they're going through these life changes, and if there is any advice you might have for them.
I can't really speak to that, but yeah, a lot of people say, oh, as I get older, I notice I'm not recovering as well from training, or I'm not able to maintain the same performance as I was at a certain age. A lot of the research we have on that is it has to do with like your training and your activity level, not necessarily your age. Because we have 80-year-olds who are competing in track events and like winning medals. And a lot of the time we might have to look back at other stuff like your training and your diet and your stress levels and your sleep to see what might be able to be manipulated there. So this is where strength training is really important too, because we will lose like after the age of 30, we lose 3 to 8% of our muscle mass per decade if we don't train to keep it. And after the age of 60, it actually accelerates. And so a lot of times, if you don't have that foundational strength and you're not doing strength training to maintain, to both build and then maintain your muscle mass at an older age, you're going to see those performance declines. Because we just don't have the muscle mass to support maintaining that level of intensity throughout your session. And so that's where making sure that we have muscle mass and that we're building muscle mass and keeping muscle mass is really, really important. And then diet is also going to be really important for a lot of people too. The older we get, we become anabolically resistant to protein, which means that the same amount of protein that like a 20-year-old would take in order to stimulate muscle protein synthesis, an older person is going to need more protein to stimulate muscle protein synthesis. So as we age, our need for protein actually increases. And so we also want to make sure that we're increasing our protein in order to maintain our muscle mass as well. And so all of that, it can be really, really important for an aging athlete is to like, we're going to need more strength training, we're going to need more protein, and we're going to need to make sure that we're keeping that in maybe even year round for some people in order to maintain performance.
I'm glad of the segue into training for more seasoned athletes and such important points. I think that cannot be overstressed as to how people need to keep doing some things differently diet, etc. But then also how some people should not shy away from doing things that they were doing before, such as with strength training. Those things become even more important. And I like to call my mom out in almost every conversation I have about strength training. Mom, do more strength training. Yeah. If you're hearing this, you're hearing this not just from me, but from experts.
Yes, mom, you should.
And not just my mom, all the moms and dads out there.
Yes, yes.
I do want to touch on diet with you for a second. But before I do that, before we totally move out of talking about strength training, I remember hearing from you to not waste time overstretching. Now, I don't want to take things out of context, but a lot of elite professional climbers seem to advocate for a strong stretching practice. So wondering if you can help clarify.
Yeah, I mean, it could be different for everybody. Some people do have like mobility concerns that might need to be addressed. Although I do think that a lot of the mobility concerns that people have are sort of arbitrary. Like a lot of times people are like, oh, I can't touch my toes. And they think that like being able to palm the ground to confer some health benefit, and it really doesn't. Like unless you need to get into those positions for your sport or your lifestyle, having more flexibility or mobility actually does not confer any health benefit. So we don't have to do it for health. Stretching also doesn't like improve performance. It doesn't reduce soreness. It doesn't improve performance unless you specifically are at a deficit for some position you need to get into for your sport. And in that case, you know, there are other things that we can do that aren't just like static stretching that can help increase our flexibility, our mobility. I've had athletes who are like, I can't high step. My hips are really, really tight. We didn't do any stretching for them. I literally just prescribed high step drills for them. And like part of their warmups was to work their feet up as high as they can. We do that for a few weeks and like, yeah, so my hip mobility has gotten a lot better and like I can high step now. I'm like, yeah, because we're practicing that skill. It's just like a position you don't get into or train very often. So now that we're doing it more, your body is like opening up that range of motion and like being able to be in that position. So sometimes it can be as simple as that. And the biggest pushback I get from climbers for anything, for strength training or anything else, is that they have time constraints. And so when I'm building a program for somebody, I'm trying to make sure that like we're getting the most bang for our buck and that we're not adding too much to the program. And for some people, static stretching is just the juice is not worth the squeeze. Like you have to do so much static stretching at such a high intensity that it's not sustainable for people. And there's other things that we can do. So like instead of prescribing like separate hip stretches for this client, we just put it into a climbing drill. So now they're getting climbing practice, they're spending more time on the wall, but they're also working on their flexibility at the same time, so it's saving them time. And I think a lot of situations can be resolved like that. Also, strength training is loaded mobility. So if we're doing like full range of motion in our strength training exercises, you're going to gain more flexibility from that. So a lot of times there's some overlap and we can get more bang for our buck by doing drills or doing like full range of motion strength training on top of the stuff that we're doing to gain mobility versus just static stretching or separately stretching outside of our sessions. Now, if you like stretching and you have time for it, sure. But the research shows you have to do a lot of stretching very frequently at a pretty high intensity. Like you need to be holding stretches for like 2 minutes at like an RP in 9. In order for these stretches to be like make meaningful improvements. And so people are often not even stretching at a long enough for a long enough duration or at a high enough intensity to get the changes that they're looking for. So I'm not like totally anti-stretching. And I think that there's some people where if they have time and they have rate limiters in their climbing where we need to improve like range of motion somewhere, then it's worth doing. Or when I work with clients who are post-surgical and they may be very tight recovering from surgery, we need to do some stretching or some loading into that range of motion to improve their range of motion, then it's necessary. But I think there's other ways to accomplish that that might be even more effective than just like static stretching. So
that was beautifully clarifying. It's all about specificity and what you said, what gives an athlete most bang for the buck. People could be a different phases of their journey to become a better athlete or just a fitter human being. And the time spent doing, let's say, moderate stretching could be utilized doing something else. Because I think you made a very, very valid point. One of the valid points you made was the importance of doing, let's say, end range stretching, you know, holding those stretches for 2 minutes or longer, people don't have typically the capacity for that unless they are they have a personal goal of trying to master like a full split, you know, or something personal like that, which is absolutely great. And the other thing you said was also very on point, which is if people are being hampered with certain kinds of limitations with their sport, then doing things which are very sport specific, like I think you made a great example of the high stepping thing. And I know that I did this a few years ago where I was somewhat, I don't know, just being the inflexible bastard that I am, I started doing more high stepping just as part of my warm up and just holding those high stretches for longer. And yeah, just, you know, direct transfer. Just right away, I could feel that difference that I was able to high step better. And that's ultimately, I think, what the goal is, not to be able to, you know, do more stretchy poses at home. Actually, before I forget, Natasha, I know that, you know, there's so much wisdom that you dispense. I know we can only cover a few things in this conversation. Would love to know how you are helping people today. I know that, you know, you provide information available online. I know you also have other programs out there. I know you're pretty sought after. So if people avail of your fount of knowledge, how do they bring that?
Yeah, the best way to find me is on Instagram. I post content there all the time. You can just find me at Natasha Barnes on Instagram. If people have injuries that they would like to work on, I do injury consultations for climbers and for other athletes, but mostly climbers. People can book those with me online, and you can find that on my website, which is just natashabarnesrehab.com, or in the link in my bio on Instagram, you can find more information about what injury consultations are, how they work, and you can book a session there. And I also do like one-on-one training with athletes, whether that's strength training, whether that's climbing training, or whether it's a combination of both. People can also find more information about that on my website. And I also have a program called the Foundational Strength Training Program, which is a program that I designed specifically to get people to start strength training more. I say it's for climbers, but it's a GPP program. So anybody could really do it. There are pull-ups and like some hangboarding and stuff in there that like if someone was not a climbing athlete, they can just not do that part if they want. But it's a general strength training program for climbers. It's actually like 6 programs. So it's like a year of programming. I have like a forum where I answer questions and I do coaching. People can get form checks so they can learn how to lift from me in the forum. And we've got like a great community there. Everybody supports each other. Everybody has like different but similar goals. People are all kinds of different levels that are in the program. And that's the Foundational Strength Training Program. I have like a pinned post on my Instagram if people want to read about it. And then you can also find more information about the program in the link in my bio on Instagram as well. But those are the main ways to work with me or get information or get help from me.
I avidly look for your knowledge nuggets online. And I know other people benefit from that as well. So yeah, I encourage everybody to find you on your website and your Instagram. We will put those links in the show notes so people know where to get you. One other question around injury prevention and also injury recovery. I know I have consulted with you over the years for a couple of different things and I've had great results. Have you had, and I think this is one topic that sometimes maybe slightly older athletes are more interested in because I'm one of them, where, you know, you go to the doctor, you have this injury and it could be something as damning as osteoarthritis. And you go to the doctor, a doctor says, stop climbing, or hey, you need something, major, like go replace this part of your body. And then also I hear that there are people out there where you look at the MRIs and their MRIs look like, mashed potatoes, but then they are still able to sometimes perform and keep living an athletic life. Do you come across those cases? Have you had, let's say, clients who've been able to, let's say, overcome these kinds of debilities and return to some kind of form? Any anecdotal stories or otherwise?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that people need to understand is that the science is shifting when it comes to like imaging and what we consider pathology on imaging. So a lot of the things that we see on imaging that we would maybe consider pathologies we're starting to look at more of like signs of aging. It's almost like getting wrinkles on your face or your hair turning gray. We don't see that as a pathology. It's just something that happens as you get old. So a lot of these things, and they don't necessarily correlate to pain or a decrease in performance for a lot of people. In fact, we have research that shows the opposite. And we actually have research in climbing specifically that shows the opposite, which I'll talk about in a second. But a lot of these things like degenerative spine changes, rotator cuff tears, labral tears, arthritis, meniscus tears, lots of these different things that we see on MRI that look really bad are actually just normal signs of aging and are not necessarily correlated with pain. And some research shows that up to like 70% of people will have these things on MRI and they're absolutely symptom-free. Another thing is that it also depends on the MRI center and the radiologist reading the report. So there's also been research that shows that you can go to 10 different radiology centers and get 10 different, completely different MRI reports. And so there's the MRI interpretation as well. You know, MRIs can be helpful in certain cases, particularly if we're trying to rule out red flags for some people, like fractures, cancer, other insidious things that may require surgery, like spinal cord injuries that like may require emergency surgery. They can be valuable for sure. And I have sent people out for imaging before, but a lot of these things are just really scary to people and they don't need to be scared of them. So one of the studies that we have now, we have studies for general population, but we also now have a climbing study that shows that the longer you've been climbing and the harder you climb, the more likely it is that we're going to see labral tears, that we're going to see cysts in the shoulder, that we're going to see rotator cuff tears and rotator cuff tendinopathy in the shoulders. And the longer you've been climbing, the harder you climb, the more likely we are to see it. And these are in asymptomatic climbers up to 14D that have these asymptomatically. And if we image the other shoulder, even when people have pain, but a lot of times even when they don't, they have it on the other shoulder too. So if you're having shoulder pain, you get an MRI, you're like, oh, I have a labral tear, got to get a surgery. If we did the other side, you probably have a labral tear there too. It's just not symptomatic. So we can't always point to those things as like the reason why somebody has pain either. And a lot of times when I consult people, they're like, should I get imaging? Like, do I need to get an MRI? And I'm like, no, because if you have shoulder pain, we're going to do things that load the shoulder so that we can prepare that shoulder to tolerate the loads that we're going to encounter in climbing. And it almost doesn't even matter like what's going on in the shoulder. We're going to do the same, whether it's a labral tear, whether it's a rotator cuff tear, we're going to do the same exercises probably. Now, the timeframes could be different for recovery potentially, or maybe there are some isolation movements that we incorporate that are a little different injury to injury, but a lot of that's going to be dictated by your symptoms and not the MRI. So we almost don't even need it for those injuries. One of the best examples I have of this is I worked with a client. She was actually in medical school at the time. She's probably a doctor now, actually. And she had what was called glenoid dysplasia. So your glenoid is your shoulder joint. And we all know that our shoulder joint is a ball and socket joint. It's a very shallow ball and socket joint. It's not as deep as like the hip ball and socket joint. Hers, she had a genetic condition where her socket, basically her glenoid, was even more shallow and sloped at an angle compared to like the average person. So she had suffered, she was a climber. She had suffered from multiple dislocations. And she was told that the only thing that would ever help is if she got like bilateral shoulder surgery to basically create a labrum, like a more deep socket for her shoulder. But she didn't want to go through the surgery. The outcomes were not certain. And obviously, like recovering from a surgery is a whole different thing. Like a lot of times people don't realize it takes a long time to recover from surgery, not because you're recovering from like what they fix in your body, but because you're recovering from the trauma of surgery. And surgery is pretty traumatic if you've ever watched surgery videos before. And so she didn't want to have to go through that. And so we worked together for several months and she did have a couple dislocations along the way. But we started incorporating strength training and we started incorporating drills where she could get more comfortable in an extended shoulder position, which is one of the positions that she would dislocate in. Her dislocations became further and further apart, and towards the end of working together, she was no longer having any dislocations at all. And she was performing at like her highest level and feeling really, really good and really confident in her shoulders. And this was somebody who literally has a genetic condition that makes her shoulder more shallow, that had had multiple dislocations and was told that they needed surgery, then that was the only way. And all we did was strengthen her shoulder. We spent a few months, like months, strengthening her shoulder in a really focused way. She was doing strength training like 3 times a week for probably 12 weeks at least. Actually, probably longer. I think we worked together for maybe like 6 months. And by the end of that, she was feeling really good. And to this day, she's still feeling really good. And she continues to keep up her strength training. That just goes to show that you can have stuff on imaging or even like genetic abnormalities that people might consider surgical, that like if you actually like rehab them well, you can not only get out of pain, but also get back to performing at the level that you want to. And I think the thing that gets missed a lot is that for most injuries, traditional physical therapy is just not adequate. And if we think about physical therapy or we think of rehab, this is a big philosophy of mine. Rehab is not different than training. It's literally the same. The only difference is that we're starting from a different point because you might have symptoms, but the methodology is the same. The goals are the same as any training plan. And with climbing, it's really high intensity on different parts of your body, you know? And so if we're doing traditional physical therapy, is it like, if you've ever gone, like, you know, it's like these really easy exercises or these light stretches, that those things do not prepare your body for the forces that you're going to experience in your sport. And so if your rehab does not look like training, it's not going to be able to get you back to your sport at a high level. And that's the thing that gets missed a lot, is that like we may need to start at a low level if you're very symptomatic, but eventually your training needs to be hard. Your rehab needs to be hard. It needs to feel like training if we're going to get back to the sport. And so that part is really important, and working with somebody who understands your sport.
Absolutely. Yes. There are few like silver bullets in life. Strength training seems to be one of them, where done correctly with the right program, right supervision, it can help overcome so many life and physical situations. One of the things I think climbers and maybe just overhead athletes at some point they encounter is you get to a point in your life and your shoulders have just seen so much abuse. The strength training and the rehab can help you get to a certain point. But beyond that, one also needs to modify the way, let's say, one climbs. So for example, if somebody has, let's say, bad shoulder condition, they need to just manage or mitigate overhead things. Can you actually find replacements, which seems so fundamental to climbing, such as doing pull-ups, right? Like, it's one of those things, hey, you want to climb, you should be able to pull your weight up. Are there things that you advise such clients for, hey, okay, you cannot be doing too much. You need to bring that volume down.
Exercises that can replace something like doing like pull-ups.
Yeah, there's always modifications we can make to training, or like scaling that we can do to training to manage around symptoms. So for some people, like obviously like the rehab's going to be important, but especially with chronic injuries or injuries where like overuse type injuries, the reason you got to that place in the first place is because there's something going on with your training or the way that you train. I'm not saying like the way that you train, like your form or something. I'm saying like your volume, your intensity, your frequency, the way that you structure your actual climbing or training. There's something that your shoulder is not tolerating. And so a lot of times we do need to modify temporarily. Either changing volume, intensity, frequency, or avoiding certain positions temporarily so that we can get ahead of symptoms. But there's almost never a reason to like completely avoid positions forever. But if we do have to avoid positions temporarily, there's so many different ways to manage. So like, for example, you might think that like a pull-up is very important, but it's not. And you don't have to be doing like a full range of motion strength exercise, like a pull-up, in order to keep your shoulders strong. A lot of times what I'll have people do is like a weighted two-arm walk-off where we're holding at 90 and we're weighting it. And you're going to get a lot of the same benefits. If not, I actually find that exercise transfers better to climbing than a full pull-up. And that is usually pretty well tolerated by most people. Like I have my shoulder surgery patients doing that exercise and they can tolerate it versus like a full pull-up where they might not tolerate the hanging position or the very top position. same thing with like some people are like, oh, it really hurts to like, you know, do if we could modify like the range of motion, like it really hurts to bend over and pick up a barbell off the ground because I'm struggling with some back pain. Sometimes it's just about scaling the load and starting with a weight that does feel tolerable. But for some people, we can modify the range of motion. So we can do a rack pull or we can elevate the bar off the floor a little higher so you're not bending over as far and you can still train that movement until you get more tolerant of the full range of motion. And so a lot of it depends on like the context for people, like what bothers them, why it bothers them. But a lot of times there's ways to manage around symptoms or like modify exercises so that you can still train in a meaningful way and just work around that injury or that pain that you're having.
Again, this stresses the point, Natasha, that it is so important to work with a coach, trainer, specialist who understands your needs and your sport. Otherwise, one is not going to be able to find the answers. And sometimes the answers can be really discouraging because people don't understand what you're doing. And the answers can lead you down a path which may have you stop the sport, which is not good, or maybe hurt yourself further. You know, I hope everybody listening understands that one can, in most cases, I think, continue climbing or your sport as long as one understands the importance of specificity and custom programming. Gone on for a little while. Just a few fun questions, Natasha, before we wrap up. You know, you have inspired many climbers and athletes over the years. Who inspires you?
Who inspires me? I mean, there's tons of other athletes that inspire me. It doesn't even have to be like a high-level athlete, you know, like somebody who is really passionate about what they do, really consistent, inspires me. A lot of it for me, my dad inspired me as a kid because he was very athletic growing up and like he really helped us become more athletic as kids and also or encouraged us to be more athletic as kids and showed us the importance of exercise when it comes to health. So a lot of it comes from like my dad. A lot of it comes from like other athletes who are like my peers that I find really motivating or inspiring. Friends of mine that I find really motivating or inspiring. And then also just for me personally, like I think that it's fun to just try to get better at something, even if you're not good right away, you know? You salsa dance, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I learned salsa, like I started taking like private salsa classes in 2019 and I historically am not good at dancing. Like I feel like I'm not very coordinated. Everyone's like, you're crazy. Like you're a really good athlete. What are you talking about? I'm like, no, I'm telling you, like if it's something new that I've never done before, I am not good at it. I am not coordinated. I cannot dance. And so I made a point. I enjoy the process of getting better at something. And I felt really bad at dancing and I was really bad at dancing. But learning like the salsa steps and taking private lessons and committing to showing up to class like once or twice a week and going social dancing on Fridays, within a year, I was like climbing or salsa dancing really well. And like when I would go out on Friday nights, people would be like, oh, you're really good. Like I started getting compliments and I was like, oh my God, like I sucked at this when I first started. Like I couldn't do a turn. I couldn't get like my steps correct, but I just stuck with it for long enough and really took joy in like the process of learning how to become better at it, that I, you know, in a year was able to get like decent at it. And I think that enjoying the process of whatever you're doing is like a really important thing. Enjoy the process. You can get good at anything.
This is such life wisdom. My salsa journey was kind of like yours. Very difficult, you know, two left feet. Really shy, but I fell in love with the salsa learning journey, a dance learning journey, actually on a climbing trip to Cuba, full-on immersion, a month in Vinales, being surrounded by salsa, timba music, and dancing, and
so cool.
After a day of climbing, you know, would go dancing or would go out with the local kids, and it was their mothers and their aunties who were teaching me. After 1 month of that accidental immersion, I came back to San Francisco just completely obsessed. And the part about learning that, enjoying that journey is so important. I think we know that from climbing where, you know, you could be working out really, really hard and you don't even notice. You're just flowing in the moment. you and I need to go sausage dancing.
Yeah, that'd be fun. It's been a minute for me, but like it comes back fast. I went to like the whatever that Friday night thing they have it in San Francisco. I went earlier last year. Yes, Base 550. And I was like, oh, I haven't salsa danced in a minute. But I just went and showed up to the class and like got a little warm up, like icebreaker. And then I heard everything. Like it came back really fast, you know?
Muscle memory is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I was like, oh, wow. I did salsa long enough that like it comes back. Like if I had only done it for like a month or two, I wouldn't be able to have it come back like that, you know? But like it's almost, it comes back to me like riding a bike again.
I think we both have our climbing friends and other, let's say, outdoor adventure type friends who will not dance. And I try to explain to them and I usually give up and I try to tell them that, hey, if you like music and you like physical activities, it's really just a fusion of the two. You just have to give dancing that time where you know you're going to suck because you're a beginner and you could be a beginner at golf. But if you just are willing to suck through it, it can unlock like a beautiful activity, like a lifelong type of... Any goals you still have with climbing, Natasha? Because, hey, I think me and a lot of people listening know you first and foremost as a rock crusher.
Yeah, I don't know. During the pandemic lockdowns, I built a climbing wall in my backyard and got back into climbing after like taking six years off. And thanks to strength training, like I was literally able to get back to climbing V9 like in a year. And when I came back to it, I never climbed like harder. My highest grade bouldering ever was like V11. And I never managed to top that. But it's because I'd never tried anything that hard outdoors. But what I did notice was that coming back into the gym, thanks to strength training, I could send like V7, V8, sometimes flash them at the gym, and was sending like V9s pretty quickly outside and sending like a lot of like V7s and V8s in the gym, which was like literally not a thing I could do before, even when I was climbing V11 outside. So by that measure, I was definitely stronger and a better athlete at that point. And then I think I decided to sign up for a powerlifting competition at some point and then stopped climbing again. And then I've just been like very inconsistently climbing recently. But it's really easy for me to get back into it when I want to. It takes like a couple months for my fingers and forearms to sort of catch up. But the rest of my body is like there, you know, thanks to strength training consistently. But I don't know. I tend to like follow the psych. So like last year, I was like a little bit more excited about climbing. So I was doing more of that. And we had like a good like training crew that would get on the moon board. And then we did that really consistently for like a year. And then everybody's schedules changed. And so suddenly I didn't have like my crew anymore. And so I just sort of started wandering back over to powerlifting again. And this year, my powerlifting has been going really well. And I'm just sort of like excited about that. So I think right now I have like more powerlifting goals than climbing goals. At least climbing performance goals. Like I can always go to the gym and just climb for fun. But I'm sure that like at some point I'll get reeled back in and get psyched on climbing again and like want to get into like some climbing performance goals. I think it would be fun to like actually train and climb something harder than what I did back when I was a professional climber, because I think I can do it. I think I just need to find a project and actually go outdoors and like project it. So that'll be fun to do at some point, but we'll see. I tend to just like, I think it's more sustainable and healthy mentally to just kind of follow the psych wherever it is, whether it's powerlifting, whether it's climbing, whether it's salsa dancing. And so that's sort of what I do these days. And right now my psych is a little bit more in powerlifting just like at the moment.
Psych helps us do impossible things. So, yeah. But hey, doesn't matter the grade, any dream climbs, you're like, hey, you know, whenever I get back into my season of climbing again, this is something that I want to have my sights on. Could be a route, could be a boulder problem.
Yeah, I would really, I don't have like, I guess one climb specifically. I've been to Magic Wood in Switzerland, and there's a V13 there called Pura Vida, and I did it in two overlapping pieces in like 2005. And so I would love to like train and go back and like send that, because I think it fits me really well. I think it would be a good candidate for topping my previous level. But it's so far away, you know. Locally, I think it would be fun to get back into sport climbing. Like, I really miss the jailhouse days, and like going to jailhouse and like sport climbing there was just so fun. Like, I would love to go back there and climb more hard stuff there. Yeah, I don't know. Other than that, I don't have anything like super specific on my mind. I would love to go to South Africa at some point and Boulder, because it just looks like incredible. There's like some sport climbing in Mexico that looks rad, like El Salto looks rad, and like those places I would love to go visit. So there's definitely places that are like bucket list places.
Sometimes I think that climbing is just my excuse to visit all these magical places and immerse myself in because otherwise I can't just be a tourist. You know, it's not fun just being just looking at sites and taking photographs. A couple of fun last questions, Natasha. If there was a big billboard out there, you could have anything written on it, what message would you want to send out?
Wow, I would have a billboard that says strength training is healthcare. And I would want more medical doctors and physical therapists and chiropractors to be aware of the physical activity guidelines and be recommending those things to people of all ages, whether it's kids, whether it's adults, whether it's like older adults. I think everybody should be doing it. And I think that it is healthcare.
That's short and strengthening. Let me add, what's been the best use of $100?
Best use of $100? I don't know. Probably spending it on food, which is awesome and like an experience and also tasty. I don't know.
What's a meal that you could have every day?
A meal that I could have every day. I really love, I have this like recipe for like protein pancakes that I love. And it's so tasty and like you can't even tell there's like a ton of protein in it. It's just like delicious raspberry pancakes. I could probably eat that like every day.
Let every day be a decadent breakfast day.
Breakfast is the best meal, honestly. Like, I can have breakfast for lunch and dinner.
I love that. It's been a lovely conversation, Natasha. Thank you so much for taking the time out today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast. It was fun to talk about all that stuff.
Thanks for tuning in, friends. I had so much fun talking to Natasha. I'm still glowing. She was such a joy to speak to, humble and knowledgeable and articulate about climbing and strength training, and full of wisdom and optimism for all of us who continue to push our goals despite age and other challenges. Her message of strength training is healthcare is one we should all take to heart, no matter our age or ability level. As Natasha demonstrated, with the right approach, we can overcome injuries, defy expectations, and keep progressing in our passions year after year. Let's follow her lead and embrace strength work as a foundational practice. Remember, you can find Natasha at Instagram and at natashabarnesrehab.com for online coaching, program, and other resources. Until next time, stay on the move, stay learning, and stay with your goals, my ageless friends.